Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So, if the order of the day is change, Matthew Miller has a few modest proposals he'd like to share. You probably know Matt Miller from his writings, his appearances on the show, from his role in the public radio program Left, Right, and Center. He's the center guy, heard Sunday mornings at 6:30 on WNYC. Miller's brand new book is called The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. But a warning, some of the old ideas he declares dead might scare you. Our kids will learn more than we do. Dead. Employers should be responsible for health coverage. Dead. Schools are a local matter. Dead. Let's jump in there. Matt Miller, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Brian.
And we'll do big picture as we go along, but let me start with a particular idea that our children will live better than we do. That's an idea that represents hope and belief in progress. That's a big central idea of our country to declare dead.
It is, and no one wants to say that that our kids won't live better than we do, but I think if you look at the new research, and that was really what I was trying to do with this book, is to put out there a set of things that we need to rethink. Today, up to 100 million people live in families that are earning less than their parents did at a similar age. Now, that's a stunning fact, and that's before we've had the full economic integration with rising powers like China and India. So I think we have to acknowledge that the rise of the rest of the world, which from humanity's point of view is a wonderful thing, is going to pose real wage stresses for a big chunk of our population. And if we deny that, it doesn't do anyone any good. But if we realize it, we can actually take steps to make life better, even if we're going to have some tougher situation.
We accept it only if it's a zero-sum game, don't we? I mean, does this mean you don't believe in economic growth as a basic economic goal or likelihood?
No, I think we will have economic growth, and I think we'll certainly get past this recession and this crisis that we're in. But when we're on the far side of that, there's still a lot of problems we face. And even if we have economic growth, which we will, it's really skewed. Right now, the top of the income distribution, the most talented and most highly educated, are really getting the lion's share of all the benefits of growth, and tons of people are being left behind. And it's going to take some policy changes to actually make sure that we share the benefits of growth more equitably.
So what do we do on a policy level? That's not a form of surrender to decline if we accept that our children won't live better than we do.
Well, one of the things that I think that being in the grip of this dead idea has led us to think wrongly about is that we've overestimated the power of the individual to determine his own economic destiny. That's sort of the classic American myth, which is Horatio Alger or Jay Gatsby in literature. You know, that people can invent themselves and come out of nowhere and through hard work build themselves up. Now, obviously, that's true for a lot of folks in America, but there are forces now at work in the global economy that mean that even hardworking folks are going to end up on tougher times. And that means it doesn't make sense, for example, that your health security and your family's health security is tied to a job that could disappear. You know, for the richest country in the world, that doesn't make sense anymore.
And one of the stats in your book that really struck me, and I don't have it in front of me, but had to do with the social mobility, and that at one point in our history, it was much more likely for someone who came from a lower income family to move up to, you know, an upper middle class income, let's say, than it is today. You know what stat I'm talking about?
Yes, and it's declined enormously because it used to be, it was, after World War II, there was an extraordinary number of people who were born in the bottom quarter of the income distribution who ended up in the top quarter. And what you see now, depressingly, is that there are a lot of European countries, which we usually think of being these class-ridden feudal societies in terms of their history. They have kids who are born in poor situations have a better chance of rising than they do in America. That should shame us, but it also should be a call to action.
Matthew Miller, author of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, my guest on WNYC. You can take your phone calls, 212-433-WNYC, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Again, our phone number, 212-433-9692 for Matt Miller today. All right, let's go through more of the Tyranny of Dead Ideas list. Taxes hurt the economy. Dead idea?
It is. You know, this is one of those unspeakable things in our political culture, but taxes are going up no matter who is in power in the next decade, and the economy is going to be fine. We're not going to become France or Sweden. It's perfectly consistent to have higher taxes and strong economic growth, but what neither party wants to talk about right now, and to be sure, you know, in the next 18 months or so, we may be cutting taxes because we're trying to boost the economy. But after that, when we send the baby boomers off to their rocking chairs, we're going to double the number of people on Social Security and Medicare, and the math doesn't work at current levels of taxation. So one way or another, taxes will inevitably rise. In the book, I quote a lot of John McCain's senior advisors from the last presidential campaign, who are obviously Republicans, who acknowledge exactly that. So it's one of those things that people don't want to discuss, and it's particularly hard for the Republican Party to let go of this tax-cutting mantra. But taxes will go up, and the idea that it's going to hurt the economy is just not right.
But take me there a little bit further. I mean, without being an ideological supply-sider about it, don't taxes remove incentives for investment and innovation? That maybe raising taxes in good times might slow down an overheated economy, but raising them in hard times takes an anti-stimulus direction by moving money from private sector circulation?
As I said, we don't want to raise taxes right now while we're in the middle of this recession. But if you look at the long term, and we will get past these, you know, this crisis, and once we get past that, there's no question. It's a matter of math that as we double the number of people on these retirement programs, taxes will have to rise. And the myth is that that's going to be a problem because our own history. Remember, we once had much smaller taxes ourselves. You know, before the Depression, before World War II, when taxes rose enormously then to finance the war, after World War II, we ended up in a permanently higher level of taxes and spending. And that was the greatest boom for 30 or 40 years that we ever knew. So the idea that higher taxes is going to be the death knell for the economy is plain wrong. I understand why politicians on both sides are afraid to talk about it, but we may as well change our thinking now because the truth is the real question will be how to tax ourselves smarter for the revenue we need.
Another dead idea from the tyranny of dead ideas. Schools are a local matter, and I'm a true believer with you on this one. When are we going to get with the rest of the educated world and have national standards and make education a national mission? We're falling farther and farther behind the countries we think we're competing with and that our national psyche tells us we're superior to. But what to do? Do you like No Child Left Behind?
It did some good things and did some bad things, which we can get into. But in the point, people should understand, I'm not against local involvement, you know, deep parental involvement in schools. That's not what we're talking about. But we're unique in the advanced world in having 15,000 local school districts, often with 15,000 separate sets of standards, and more importantly, a local funding base. Now, in the 18th century, in the 19th century, this made sense because people of different wealth didn't live in all these different little taxing districts. Today, we do. So now, by accident of birth, that determines how much money is spent on your education, and it's one of the greatest injustices we face, and no one talks about that.
School funding through national taxation and distribution?
A bigger role. So today, for example, the feds contribute 9 cents on every dollar of K-12 education. I think we should go up to 25 or 30% at the national level, which is actually an idea Richard Nixon, who, you know, you might think was our last liberal president, actually looked at in the early 70s before he ran into some other trouble.
Matt Miller, author of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. We'll get to new ideas to replace the dead ideas as we go. Here's a nice shout-out for you from the top of our comments page for this segment. Peter from Sunset Park writes, please thank Matt Miller for being part of one of the best political podcasts available. I love to hear Robert Scheer and Tony Blankley find common ground and disagree. I also like how Matt Miller is clearly a Democrat but doesn't have a problem with supporting Republican ideas when he sees fit. So left, right, and center, 6:30 Sunday mornings here on WNYC. Anna in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there. I think that some of the ideas that you're discussing are pretty dangerous because while I understand that there, some of them, like the school issue, okay, that maybe localized could go bigger. But, I mean, I think fashions change, and I think that we know from public policy work that it's the conversation is going on long before things change. And I think that, you know, if we change our expectations where, you know, the general consensus in the world is that, or in the United States, is that we're not going to have health care or that from our work, that is now, you know, becoming that becomes the dominant thought, and then the, you know, subsequent business follows suit. And I think that we have to have more expectations, if anything, and find the way to do that than to say these are dead ideas. And there we really know that, you know, Bernie Madoff was fashionable a few years ago. He's not today. I mean, it changes. And the same thing is going on, I'm sure, for other issues right now.
I do think we want to be careful about what's in fashion, but I guess one of the things I'm trying to do with the book then is to show the history of all these ideas so people understand why things that may have worked for 50 years or 100 years, what the tradition was, where did local control come from? Where did the idea come from that your company should take care of you, that we should look to our employers, not our country, for support on things like health care and pensions? And I think if you look at this history, you can see that there were sort of particular circumstances where the idea may have made sense long ago. But when you look at the forces of the global economy today and the trends that we're facing, these old ways of thinking don't make sense anymore. And I think in circumstances like that, we have to rethink. And not only that, I think the pressure of events over the next decade are going to force us to rethink. So it's really a kind of guide to the future.
So healthcare was basically a fringe benefit started to be offered by companies when there was a labor shortage at the end of World War II, correct?
That's part of it, and that's the standard story that gets told, which is that they were offered then and it was exempt from the wage and price freeze during World War II, and then the feds came in and gave a big tax subsidy to ratify that arrangement, and it really grew, and most of us now get our health care from our employer. But the more interesting story, as I did the research, was really back in the early 1900s when you had the first rebellion against the brutalities of industrial capitalism, and unions were forming, and in Europe socialism was on the rise, and there was a real concern by the corporate community and by their conservative political allies in the U.S. that if they didn't find some way to keep a lid on employee discontent, that the state would grow and that unions would grow. And so the solution arrived at was to give benefits through the company. And that ended up being sustainable for a long time. But my argument is it helped us beat back communism and socialism. But that war is over. That's not our problem now. The real threat is protectionism if we don't address the anxiety so many workers feel.
Anna, did you want to follow up?
No, I mean, that's fair enough. I think that the language that you initially used was more sweeping than that, and I understand from the historical perspective, so that makes sense to me. I just think we do have to be careful with what, because I just find that, you know, most of the times when these things change, it's pick and choose, and so we, rather than to go to a better model, that sometimes it just, you know, reverts to, oh, well, we don't have to pay for health care anymore.
Thank you very much, Anna. And what is your better model if we're going to detach health care from the workplace? Are you a single-payer guy?
I'm not a single-payer guy. I am for a bigger government role in making sure that every American has basic health coverage. I don't like the Canadian or British single-payer model, but it's perfectly possible to have what I think of as market-friendly universal health coverage, where the government would make sure everybody had a voucher or a certificate so that low-income people would be subsidized to buy a decent Chevrolet basic health care plan from among competing private insurers. And that model's been tested in places like Switzerland and Holland, and it works great. So we just need to get there.
We may need to find a newer metaphor than basic Chevrolet for this month. Maybe that's from the
tyranny. A solid Toyota. That's right.
Tyranny of dead metaphors. Well, this, I think, relates to your list of new ideas to replace the tyranny of dead ideas, like only government can save business and only business can save liberalism. How do those two go together?
Well, only government can save business, and I mean that beyond just the sense in which we're doing all these emergency, you know, interventions and the capitalizing the banks and doing all this other stuff in this crisis. But I think the only way we're going to get to the health care and pension security we need for the country is for the government to play a much bigger role in financing those things. Right now, business is bearing this huge chunk of America's welfare state. Again, it may have made sense 80 years ago or 40 years ago, but it doesn't make sense now. The problem is that business people themselves need to change their minds on this, because they tend to be so ideologically opposed to government per se that they worry that if they let go of this, government will somehow make a mess of it. But the truth is, business itself is being destroyed by these soaring costs, and in every other advanced nation, government plays a bigger role. Now, only business can save liberalism. I think sometimes this is a harder case for liberals to hear. But the truth is, in healthcare and education, two of the biggest sectors of the economy, we are radically inefficient compared to all the other advanced countries. We spend much more than these other countries on healthcare and on education, and we get less out of it. The only way to change that is to re-engineer the cost structure of these sectors. And to do that, so we make healthcare and education more efficient, that's going to take entrepreneurial drive and innovation. I'm not talking about privatization or George Bush's kind of privatizing agenda, but we have to make room, like for the retail clinics that appear in a lot of the retail stores now, those health clinics where you can go in and get shots or strep throat analysis or get the kids, you know, temperature taken, et cetera, for very low prices. We're going to need innovations like that in education and healthcare to help make the things that liberals care about affordable in the long term.
Mike in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. This is a very entertaining segment, and I can't say that I disagree with quite a few of the gentleman's policy prognostications, but there seems to be a fundamental flaw in what you're doing, a methodological flaw, which is you're taking single-dimension items and ignoring the fact that there are all sorts of other factors that influence these things. A simple example, the discussion about taxes being good or bad for the economy. Well, that may or may not be so, but to discuss, to use as a comparison, a time before the Second World War, when there was a major financial disaster, the Depression, brought about, most people would say, by things like excessive tariffs and bad fiscal policy and so forth, and then compare it to a time after the Second World War when the United States has 50% of industrial production and all our economic competitors have been devastated by a war, and saying, see, the economy was good even though taxes were high, isn't really a very... I mean, it kind of leaves out a lot of other factors that may have at least as much or more influence.
Mike, thank you.
It's a good point. But I'm not saying it's the only factor, but if you look at the long sweep of history, the march of civilization has been marked by a transition among countries that were growing wealthier from lower taxes to higher taxes because people wanted to have more of the services that we could only do in common. Better police protection, a stronger military, better schools, better health care system, some kind of pension protection for everyone. And if you look, and I go through all this research and history in the book, the truth is, and you wouldn't know it from the way our political debate, which is very warped today, is that the growth in taxes over time has been associated with greater wealth and greater income. And I'm saying that we don't need to fear the fact that taxes will inevitably rise because it's consistent with the same kind of economic thriving we've had before.
Our comments board on this is actually pretty funny. People seem mostly interested in saying whether they like Robert Scheer or Arianna Huffington better in the left seat on your show. But Roger from New Rochelle writes, I hadn't realized Matt Miller had become such an honored pundit. I went to Columbia Law School with Matt in the early 1980s. Is that the same you? You should ask him to sing. He was a featured player and director of our law school show and has quite an excellent voice. But I think I'll pass.
We'll sing another time.
On detaching health care from the workplace.
Yes.
You even want to detach pensions from the workplace, don't you?
Well, I'm not against if companies want to offer pensions atop the basic pension like we have today. We have Social Security, and then companies offer a pension, additional pension offerings on top of that. I think that's fine, but I think it's going to be the government's responsibility to make sure that every American has some base level of pension protection that we finance somehow collectively, people through their private savings. Maybe the government will match lower income folks when they save so that we have pension accounts that can grow that aren't dependent on being randomly at an employer who happens to provide pension coverage, because employers are finding a hard time doing that in a global economy.
Another of your dead ideas, money follows merit. Now, we know it doesn't always work that way, but is the idea wrong-headed? Isn't that the ideal?
I guess I think that one of the most cherished myths of the, especially educated people in America, or a certain sliver of educated people in America, is the idea that market capitalism is basically a meritocracy, that people end up economically where they deserve to. And I think that is the lower upper class, what I call the lower upper class, has had the veils lifted from their eyes in recent years as we see all the rise of what I think of as the undeserving ultra-rich, when you've got CEOs who essentially bankrupt these companies while walking off with $100 million for their troubles when you've got all the bankers who peddled the junk subprime mortgages, who many of whom are retired to their country clubs now while the entire country is picking up the bag. I think that that has awakened the lower upper class, professionals, journalists, media observers, senior vice presidents of marketing, to the fact that the people who are doing that well income level don't have more, quote, merit than they do. And I believe that that's going to create a kind of empathy among a very powerful segment of our society for those who are struggling below them, lower on the income scale, who are being buffeted by global economic forces over which they have no control, and that'll be a constituency for change.
All right. All right. Two-minute drill. Three last quick questions. one more new idea. Only the lower upper class can save us from equality. What does that mean?
Only the lower upper class can save us from inequality means that I think that the brewing resentment from the lower uppers is actually going to create a constituency for a kind of comeuppance agenda that will lead to some higher taxes on the very, very ultra-rich, even as we expand safety net protections for the rest of us.
Does something tie together your dead ideas and new ideas? Is there a central philosophical principle underlying all this?
I think it would be that we've reached a point, not to be too grand about it, in the history of American capitalism where the role of the community as opposed to the role of the individual in his own success needs to be rebalanced. And because there are so many economic forces now buffeting more and more of the country, we're going to need to make sure that as a community we come together to assure opportunity and security in the way a wealthy advanced nation ought to.
And the Obama folks declare themselves pragmatists, unwedded to old ideas, in a way that seems similar to you. How close are they to you?
I hope very close. I mean, I think Barack Obama, whom I admire a great deal, has a unique moment because of the economic crisis he's inheriting to really force us to rethink and lead us in rethinking a lot of these old ways of doing business. So we'll see in a couple of weeks as he gets started how successful he can be.
All right. Our program director, Chris Bannon, is going to come by and say hi to you in a minute. He says he sang with you as an undergrad, so it all comes back to your singing in college. But if you want to hear more Matt Miller, singing excluded, I presume, he is giving a talk at noon tomorrow for the think tank Demos at 220 Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. 220 Fifth Avenue at noon tomorrow, the think tank Demos. To hear more Matt Miller, contact Demos for more information. And the book is The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. Matthew Miller, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come this hour, how to end the Gaza war with justice for both sides and how design reflects recession. Stay tuned.